The Murthy law firm has been clarifying US immigration laws and procedures for foreign nationals since 1994. We are happy to offer this free service. Please listen to copyright information and restrictions at the end of this recording.
Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us for today's discussion on what to expect with H-1B filings and RFEs starting from January of 2025. As most of you know, as all of us practically know at this point, we're going to have a new administration that is starting from January 20th onwards. And we believe that there will be a whole lot of changes to expect in the H-1B world. And so whether you're an employer, an employee, an HR person, or anybody impacted by H-1s, you want to make sure that you know how to deal with the new rules. By way of introduction, I'm Sheila Murthy, President and CEO of the Murthy Law Firm, and I'm delighted and honored to welcome and introduce two of my esteemed colleagues at the Murthy Law Firm, Kevin Andrews, who's been with the firm about 15 years, Anu Parmeshwaram, who has been with the firm about 15 years in total. Great team, brilliant colleagues and lawyers. And so we're going to talk a little bit about different issues that will impact you. So I'm going to just start off very, very briefly to state what many of you probably at least know, even if you don't actually use it daily, that the H-1B specialty occupation is meant for a job that requires at least a bachelor's degree in a specific field of study in order to perform the role. And you may wonder, well, why do you need to mention that? That's so obvious, right? Well, because based on that, you're going to see potential RFEs, notice of intentions to deny, possible extension denials or RFEs, et cetera. Now, we keep in mind that even though the law generally requires at least a bachelor's degree or higher level education in order to perform the H-1B specialty occupation type of job, the law actually permits a combination of the education, which is directly connected and or related experience, which can be combined together to make it the equivalent of a bachelor's degree. And in order to do that mix and match, so to speak, it would require some type of an expert opinion, you know, from a college professor, somebody that's qualified or who has the authority to grant college level like equivalency in exchange, and they would basically show most likely how every 3 years of work experience equates to 1 year of the college degree, right? And the USCIS actually has explained in their new rule that's going to be introduced, right, that the title of the degree alone is not going to be determinative, and that degree titles could differ among schools and even evolve over time, which, of course, being good lawyers, I guess we could use that in many ways to argue certain fields of study which are directly related to the H-1 occupation. The government may take the opposite position, especially if the new administration is determined to look at this under the magnifying glass. And, of course, all of us also know that in the last few weeks, there's been a lot of brouhaha. Once Vivek Ramaswamy mentioned something, and then Elon Musk sort of agreed with him that we need to get the best and brightest from around the world, and H-1Bs may be an avenue for the government to hire H-1B professionals. And then Trump was not sure, I guess, which camp to go into, and seems to now be leaning towards the camp where they acknowledge the importance of relying on professional specialty occupation workers or on H-1B. So I'm just giving a very brief, quick overview, and I'm going to invite Anu to maybe talk a little bit about, do we expect the deference policy memo to continue, and what is the deference policy memo, Anu? Take it away.
Yes, Sheila. So the new rule actually codifies the deference policy. So up until now, it was more just a practice that the USCIS was following. But now, because it's going to be codified effective Jan 17th, you know, this is what the policy is going to be. The deference policy instructs officers to consider and follow prior determinations when it involves the same parties and the same set of facts, unless there is a material error with the prior determination, or if there is a material change in circumstances, or if there is new information that adversely impacts the petitioner or the beneficiary's eligibility. So that's a very, you know, helpful thing to have. Then the beneficiary owner rules is another positive change. The new rule allows the H-1B beneficiaries to own controlling interest in the petitioning employer. So previously, if the beneficiary had a controlling interest, it would result in the H-1B getting denied because USCIS claimed that the lack of the employer-employee relationship, you know, would lead to denial. So this is a welcome change.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. And, you know, the really, fun thing is when I just did a consultation very recently, the person was like, I know I can own the company. I can do it now. There's no problem, right? Yeah, you still could own it under the H-1B context, but there's still a potential problem with respect to the PERM rules in terms of getting your PERM or green card approved based on owning 5% or more of the company. So even though the H-1B new rule may be very beneficial for H-1B beneficiary owners, it could potentially impact green cards. So talking about good news and continuation of the good news under the new rules, Kevin, what is this whole thing about the CAP-CAP extension? This sounds really interesting.
Yeah, this year we're sending out our list of the good stuff from the new rule is the CAP-CAP extension. So starting next year, the CAP-CAP extension is going to cover an F1 student on OPT until the following April 1st. So up until now, CAP-CAP covered from the time the H-1 was filed until September 30, you know, because the H-1B would start date is October 1. And in cases, and, you know, we saw a lot of this during the last Trump administration, if the case is still pending, I think there's a period of time when they suspended premium processing one lottery season, but if the H-1B petition is still pending on October 1st, but, you know, the individual's OPT had expired, now with the new rule, the old rule was that the beneficiary would have had to stop working until the new H-1 was approved after October 1st, but now they can continue working until April if the H-1B petition is pending. So it just gives more a broader CAP-CAP flexibility to continue work to prevent the disruption of that continuity of work.
Very good. Very interesting. And what happens after April 1? Because sometimes they take almost a year to give a decision in some cases. I guess instead of losing it on September 30th, now you have to 6 more months.
It is interesting you say that because a lot of rules sound good on paper until you apply them in practice. So this got me thinking of like H4 EAD auto renewal. You know, it's like, yeah, you get auto renewal of the H4 EAD, but only if the H4 is approved, but the EAD is still pending. It's like, well, how often does that happen? You know, like what benefit is this rule in practice? That might be the case with this. I think premium processing is a huge source of revenue for USCIS, and I would imagine, you know, even the Trump administration would try to not suspend that. So I could see how that would maybe prevent. But, you know, we don't predict the future. We map out the possibilities for it. So yeah, you're absolutely right. It might not be as beneficial. We have to wait and see how it plays out in practice.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, even if it's you don't have an answer, getting 6 extra bonus additional months for the USCIS to process it and not having to pay thousands and thousands of dollars in premium fees for employers and employees who may need that immediate decision for multitudes of reasons makes it a whole lot nicer and better. So now let's switch gears a little bit to talking about working at client locations. Many of you will remember that from like 2010 till about 2020, the USCIS would routinely ask us for contracts, letters, purchase orders, statements of work from clients and any MIT vendors who are involved in the project. Now, most of that actually stopped sometime in early to mid 2020 after there was a lawsuit that was filed against the USCIS. But under this new rule, starting in 2025 January, the USCIS actually has the authority to now request contracts, work orders, or similar evidence. And we certainly expect the incoming Trump administration to ask or require some or a lot or some or all of this information, because we know from the last time around that there were a lot more it was much harder to obtain those H-1 petition approvals. Also, there's some kind of a combination that education network experience that applies. So Anu, I don't know if you want to jump in.
Sure, Sheila. So there's a change in the new rules. You know, up until now, we were focusing on what the employer's requirements were for the position. But in the new rules, it now says that the client requirements should be considered when confirming the minimum requirements for a position. Just to give you an example, say if the employer requires a bachelor's and 3 years of experience, the prevailing wage level chosen normally would be a wage level 2 on the LCA. But then USCIS goes to the client and asks them what the client requirements are, and say if the client says, well, we need a master's and 5 years of experience for the project, then USCIS will interpret this to mean that the LCA should have had a wage level 4 on the LCA instead of a level 2. So this could result in the petition getting revoked, and they could go after the employer for back wages. So a good practice moving forward from, you know, Jan 17, 2025 onwards would be to make sure that the client requirements are consistent with the employer's requirements on the H-1B petition and the LCA.
You know, Anu, we've actually seen these cases already. You know, we're seeing, I think I saw at least one notice of intent to revoke and one RFE where it says just this. They went to the client says they have some higher requirement than the employer. And I think when we saw the first one, it was a few weeks, or maybe even a month or more before the final reg was published. And we were scoffing at this. We were like, this is ridiculous. You know, clients have preferences, but that's not what employers require necessarily. Now they've codified it. So,
right.
You know, Yeah.
Up until now, you know, whenever we see this, you know, occasionally we used to argue, no, the employer's requirements, you know, is what, you know, should matter. But now that they've codified this, hereafter it's going to be the client requirements. So, you know, we all have to be really mindful. Employers need to be very mindful about it.
Mm-hmm. Or, as I remember some of the senior attorneys would say during the American Immigration Lawyers Association's conference, that every single person who's a lawyer can interpret the law. And just because the agency has given it a particular interpretation, and we now even know that the Chevron deference isn't being given to prior deferential rules, so the agency's interpretation of this statute would certainly be something that could potentially be challenged, and good, smart lawyers, whether it's with you all within your companies or your in-house general counsel or class action lawsuits of the government now requiring a totally different set of criteria. Because if I want something and the client's like, oh, I'm so happy your person has that and then some extra education and experience, and now that's going to become the mandatory minimum and hold me liable, because after 3 months, if I get a new client with a completely different set of background and education, I'm now again required to file another new H-1 petition amendment to change the criteria, the requirements, the level, wage levels, et cetera. I think it's opening it up a little bit in a strange and bizarre way. And I think in a sad way, it's going to be a time of some turbulence, but adding more confusion to an already complicated and difficult process certainly isn't going to help us. Kevin, did you want to add something about the locations?
Yeah, well, just that I've spoken to a few employers about this already, and, you know, basically what I tell them is, you know, I don't think this is right. I think Loper Bright, you know, that the Chevron, getting rid of the Chevron deference and being able to more easily sue the government for administrative interpretation is probably like a useful thing in this kind of situation. But I recognize, you know, not everybody wants to be plaintiffs. Some people just want to be petitioners. And so for those petitioners out there, talk to your clients. And you know, if the client insists on having higher requirements and it's not working for you, this probably isn't the right person to place at this particular project at this particular time. but I agree that somebody is probably likely to challenge this interpretation in the next few years because it's very aggressive. I agree.
What about the whole LCA issue about two or more physical locations?
So, you know, up until now, the regulations have required that if there's more than one physical work location in the LCA, that you need to have an itinerary showing, you know, where the people will work. In the past, this hasn't really been that onerous of a requirement because you could list like percentages, you know, 50% here, 50 there, 60, 40, 80, 20, 90, 10, whatever it was. During the last Trump administration, not uniformly, but in a lot of cases, they would start to challenge, like, well, this isn't specific enough to, you know, let us know if there's real specialty occupation work. And it seemed like they started to want an itinerary the way, you know, the way you have an itinerary when you go on a cruise, like Monday I'm in Puerto Rico, Tuesday I'm in extended, you know, wherever. And it was like, well, this is very difficult to do. Now, COVID sort of glossed over that because during COVID, is, you know, maybe even after, a lot of folks, people working from home and then continue to work from home. It's like, and so we would say 100% from home while COVID is happening, but maybe, you know, it'll reverse after the end of COVID. That was with the Biden administration. They accepted it. So yeah, it was kind of a worry, like maybe we're gonna have to do really specific itineraries with the Trump administration, but thankfully the new rule, I guess this is one extra, not the greatest positive, but it's still technically a positive, is that itineraries for multiple locations are not going to be required anymore. You could just, you can have more than one physical location, but you don't have to specify the amount of time or the percentage of time or the specific days of week that you'd be working at those locations, which was something required by regulation up until next January 18th when this changes.
Great. Thank you very much, Kevin. I guess there's a silver lining in the cloud about not needing the itinerary and the detailed thing for the two job, because especially, like you said, post-COVID, a lot of people are allowed, many companies are allowing 1 or 2 days or sometimes a couple of days in a week or some even more work from home policy for their employees. So not having them mandatorily right about that certainly is a big benefit. The next thing that we expect, of course, are requests for evidence or RFEs. Many of you will recall, those of you who had been processing H-1 petitions, that in the prior Trump administration, we had a lot more RFEs. So there's a good chance that we should and we could expect some increase in the RFE rate compared with the Biden administration's RFE rate. And if you recall, most of the common issues that come up in the RFEs are a variety of issues, and I'm going to invite both Kevin and Anu to jump in a minute. But the main thing, that first point that they would go after was, hey, tell us how this job is a specialty occupation. And so they would often require more information. And as attorneys, we would then prepare a much more detailed job description, ask the employer and the employee to help with creating and expanding upon their job duties, maybe attaching an expert opinion letter from a college professor in a relevant field to help analyze and show that it's a specialty occupation. And then the next issue was generally the beneficiary's qualifications. And so, Anu, I don't know if you want to jump in here.
Another issue that we commonly see in RFE is the beneficiary's qualification. So if the employee does not have a bachelor's degree in a directly related field, the case may be subject to higher scrutiny if relying on experience evaluation from a college professor. For example, experience letters are needed to prove the work experience, and if specific details like the dates of employment or the job title or job duties are not mentioned, then USCIS could say that the expert did not have sufficient evidence to make the opinion, and they would generally disregard and not give due consideration to those letters.
Got it. Thanks, Anu. And Kevin, what about the whole maintenance of status sort of issues?
Yeah, so rounding out our core issues that we commonly see with RFEs, specialty occupation qualifications, so maintenance of status, I really think this could be a big one for the Trump administration. So usually, when you submit an H-1B, you know, transfer, or maybe even, an H-1B transfer, you have to show maintenance of status to be eligible for extension of status. Typically, that evidence is just going to be the two most recent pay stubs and current H-1B approval, to show, you know, look, this person has an H-1B approval and they're currently maintaining status. Look at these pay stubs. The last Trump term, USCIS would often ask for all pay stubs and W-2s since last approval. And then look through any, you know, oh, here's one pay period 2 years ago where maybe it looks like they were benched without pay or something like that. And we'll use that to deny the entire extension. So I could see a return to not just like the basic maintenance, but literally all the maintenance of status documentation. And, you know, that could be very document heavy and onerous if that's something that USCIS routinely RFEs on. And then, you know, makes us want to think, well, maybe we should include that step in the initial, you know, in the initial filing. And, you know, that does seem to be consistent with this enforcement compliance, you know, vibe that we're kind of getting in mainstream media with the H-1B program and, like, you know, I guess the debate between, you know, the Sriram's and Vivek's and Elon's versus the, you know, other camp of the Republican Party. And I think where they might have a compromise and a meeting of the minds is, okay, we think H-1B is good, but I hear what you're saying that there might be, you know, fraud and compliance issues. Let's make compliance and site visits and enforcement more robust. And then we can agree that, you know, H-1B program is at least good in theory.
Got it. And what other items do they need to keep checking that are new?
Mm-hmm. So employers should regularly check in with the work from home employees to make sure that the work is being done at their home. Often work from home employees move and don't tell the employers, which lead to potential status violation and back wage liability.
Well, just say good practice with everything that we've been discussing. I think we've been just saying, hey, look, there's going to be some positives, but look at all these doom and gloom things. But, you know, what is the takeaway here? So, yes, we think that there is going to be an uptick in site visits and enforcement and compliance. So for H-1B employers, you know, it's a really good idea to prepare H-1 workers for this possibility. I think sometimes there's this perception that, you know, only bad companies, quote unquote, bad companies get, you know, site visits. And that's not probably going to be the case moving forward. So this isn't something to react to. It's something to plan for. So you got to let H-1 workers, hey, look, this is a possibility, especially if they're working at home or at a client site, because they may end up interacting with an immigration enforcement authority. So the employer should have also a designated employer contact to communicate to the investigating officer. So prepping their employees, hey, there might be a site visit, give them, you know, they should know the basics about their job, who is their employer, what is their salary, what is the job title and duties they perform. And, you know, those things should be consistent with the H-1B filing. As we said earlier, the making sure the employer and client both are on the same page about the actual minimum requirements for the position. So a lot of stuff might have been assumed or just taken for granted are like important conversations to have up front to prepare for the possibility of site visit, challenging whether the requirements are consistent with the clients. So these are just things that are a little bit of extra work associated with like the same process that you guys have been doing for many years, but to ensure still a higher chance of success even as we enter in this more aggressive climate of enforcement and compliance.
Yeah, absolutely. And having that designated point, notifying your employees, keeping them up to speed, having that point of contact where everybody has somebody that they know they could answer, ask questions, all of that we just touched upon would obviously be extremely helpful. So to try to wrap this up, obviously, I think between the new rules that become effective from January, the incoming administration, we all should expect to see a lot of changes starting from January 2025 and over the next several years pertaining to the H-1B program. And if you recall, during the prior administration, from 2016 through 2020, our H-1B and RFE strategies evolved at a rapid rate as USCIS kept coming out with new ways to request additional information. And while back in 2017, there was certainly, it appeared that the administration or the USCIS was taking aim at H-1B petitions and petitioners and employers who filed with level one wages, there are several other issues that could potentially be a trap for the unwary, from asking for contract, letters, statements of works from the client, from every mid-level vendor, et cetera. So I think it's time for all of us to be prepared for a lot of changes, to anticipate that there will be new areas that they may start to focus on and gray areas that could be stress tested with the new rules and with the new administration. But don't lose faith, don't lose hope. I think you have fantastic We've seen this before. We've been able to obtain approvals before, whether it's multi-law firm or your own company lawyers. Work with a good legal team, train your HR, train your immigration, and make sure that you can withstand whatever storms come your way, because together we will be strong, we will be tough, we will do great and wonderful things, and only success to you and your business and your family as you start the new year. On behalf of myself, Sheila Murthy, on behalf of Kevin Andrews, Anu Parmeshwaran, and our entire Murthy Law Firm team, we want to wish you, your family, and your loved ones a happy new year for 2025. Let's roll up our sleeves and be ready for whatever comes our way, and hopefully we will continue to win and become stronger and better with every mountain that we need to climb. Thank you so much. Take care and happy new year. Bye now.
This is a free service. The content is the protected, copyrighted property of the Murthy Law Firm. Unauthorized recording or dissemination of these materials without prior permission is prohibited by law. Learn about our firm, how to engage our services, and more at www.murthy.com.